You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, where does that family china set nobody wanted go to after it's donated? And what about your old discarded iPhone? We talk with the author of a new book about the life of your old stuff. Now Wisconsinites get their turn at nominating each party's 2020 presidential candidates in a few months, but the Republican ballot may not have many options. Wisconsin's partisan presidential primary is Tuesday, April 7th, and a group of state Republicans voted yesterday to block President Trump's Republican primary challengers from appearing on the ballot. That puts Wisconsin in line with a handful of other states that have either done the same or canceled their Republican primaries altogether. Patrick Marley covers politics in the State House for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he's been following this story. Patrick, good to have you back with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So what happened with that vote yesterday?
So in Wisconsin, there's a panel that's convened every 4 years. It consists of five Republicans and five Democrats, and they decide who to put on the ballot. State law says they're supposed to put on there people who are generally recognized by the media as candidates, but it leaves it to this panel alone to determine who meets that criteria. The Republicans decided that they didn't want to have the two most prominent opponents in the Republican primary, Bill Weld and Joe Walsh, on the ballot. And so they put forward only Trump's name,
which means he's the only guy
on the ballot.
So you said it's five Democrats, five Republicans, but who are those people and how do they get onto that panel?
So state law spells this out. It's the chairman of each of the major parties and then top Republicans and top Democrats from each house of the legislature, or someone that they name on their behalf, and then a committee man and a committee woman for each of the parties.
And is this a usual way that states decide who's on their ballots?
I guess I don't know what other states do. I think it varies considerably from one state to another. This is the way Wisconsin has done it for a long time. It's interesting that the Democrats were critical of this but didn't try to stop this. They didn't say anything during the meeting about it. I talked to the chairman of the Democratic Party afterward about why. He said at the end of the day he thinks it should be up to the parties themselves to determine who qualifies as a candidate. But he was critical of it, saying that it seems that Republicans don't want to have any hint of dissent within their ranks.
So as we noted, this is part of a national trend, other states either canceling their Republican primary or limiting that it's only President Trump on it. Do we have a sense of if this is happening more often than it sometimes does when there is an incumbent of either party?
Usually when someone has an incumbent candidate, and particularly for president, their party rallies behind that person. It's pretty unusual to not have that happen, though. I suppose you could look back to you had Reagan making an early run for president. But in this case, what's unusual, I think, is that, you know, Trump clearly is going to get his party's nomination. Bill Weld and Joe Walsh don't offer any kind of real threat to him in terms of his ability to get votes. But Republicans have said here and elsewhere they either, like you said, don't want a primary or don't want anyone else on the ballot.
Is there any way for former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld or former Representative from Illinois Joe Walsh to still get on the Wisconsin ballot despite this decision by the panel?
Yes, if they can get 1,000 signatures in each of the state's 8 congressional districts over the next 3 weeks, they can get themselves on the ballot. That's that's a pretty high hurdle to do in a short period of time in Wisconsin. And neither has said if they will try to do that. There is some recognition that it would be quite a challenge for them.
While they haven't commented on whether they're going to do that, did they comment on the decision in Wisconsin?
Yes, they were both very critical. They both tweeted about the issue yesterday. Joe Walsh said he says it's 10 states where this has happened to him. He says Republicans are doing it to, quote, protect their king. This isn't Russia. This isn't China. This is un-American. And Weld said essentially the same thing, that it's not the way democracy is supposed to work.
We're talking with Patrick Marley right now. He covers politics and the State House for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about the decision by a bipartisan panel yesterday to not put two challengers to President Trump on the Republican presidential primary ballot this April. Let's go to the phones, and Dave in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Dave.
Good afternoon. First of all, great topic, and I just think this is a travesty. I mean, this Trump and these people voting for him, they want it to be all about him all the time. Then they're not these other guys, Matt Dingus or George Wallace or whatever. These are good candidates. They should be included. And everything Trump does and all the people who support him are bad people. And it's just terrible. I cannot wait until we get back to business as usual with good people and good ideas.
Thanks for that call, Dave. And that is an interesting aspect of this. There are probably some Republicans who, even if they're not sure whether they would vote for one of the challengers or not, feel like they want to at least be given the choice.
That may be. And I think it's important to give the explanation that the Republican Party here is making, and that is that neither of these candidates have mounted a very serious campaign, in their opinion. They haven't had much of a campaign operation, if one at all, in Wisconsin. The chairman of the Republican Party here says he only heard from the campaign shortly before this meeting yesterday. And so he said if these candidates were really serious, you would be seeing them out there more. They'd be doing the kinds of things that need to be done to get them recognized and put on the ballot.
Well, Patrick, an interesting aspect of this whole issue is that this April presidential primary is also the general election day for the state's Supreme Court justice race. Does this move to block President Trump's challengers have any implication for that race if maybe Republican voters don't turn out because they know Trump will be the nominee?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. That's a good point. It could create a challenge for Dan Kelly. He's the incumbent justice who's on the ballot that day. He's a conservative, and so he would want as much Republican turnout as possible, even though it's a nonpartisan race. That's really who he's going to be appealing to. And so by reducing the candidates on the presidential primary to one, you've really only given conservatives one reason to come to the polls that day. That would be the race for Supreme Court, unless there's a local race that somebody's interested in. And then for the Democrats, are going to and liberals are going to have a lot of reasons to come to the polls. There's obviously a huge primary, at least at the moment, on the Democratic side, and then there will also be the Supreme Court race. So already people were expecting that liberals had an advantage in one way in the Supreme Court race because turnout for Democrats is expected to be so high in the presidential race. This may have made it marginally better for Democrats, worse for Republicans in terms of turnout because there's so little, there is no choice on the Republican side.
Well, Patrick, thanks so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Patrick Marley. He covers politics and the State House for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He was with us today to talk about a vote by a group of Wisconsin Republicans yesterday to clear President Trump's challengers from the state primary ballot. That's ahead of Wisconsin's partisan presidential primary on Tuesday, April 7th. Coming up, we'll meet a Wisconsin teen who's sharing her love of dance as a way for children and adults to reduce stress. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we talk with a Wisconsin teen who's helping her classmates and adults deal with stress by dancing. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's a story about a one-hit wonder from Stoughton.
So what are some of your early memories of rock and roll? For Stoughton's Bill Amundson, there's one that happened really close to home, like right down the street.
It was a normal Saturday spring morning at the Amundson household on Norris Street in Stoughton, Wisconsin.
This is Detective Huckleberry Hound.
The year was 1960, and I was a 7-year-old boy watching Huckleberry Hound when my dad burst into the room. He said, "The band that's on the radio, they're practicing in the garage right down the street." He then proceeded to hustle my brother and I down to the old Hanson Garage, where we had a front row seat to a rehearsal by Stoughton's very own one-hit wonders, the Fendermen.
Good morning, Captain. Well, good morning to you.
Phil Humphrey was living in Stoughton, working as a truck driver and taking classes at the UW when he met Jim Sunquist of Niagara, Wisconsin. The two quickly bonded over their Fender guitars and the unusual fact that they shared the same birthday, November 26th, 1937. They formed a duo, dubbed themselves the Fendermen, and began playing gigs at small clubs and bars around southern Wisconsin. Their set was mostly country and rockabilly standards, but they couldn't help but notice that folks went wild for their rather unhinged cover of the old Jimmy Rogers song Blue Yodel No. 8, usually called Mule Skinner Blues. They tried selling the 45 on their own, with little luck, until a lacrosse DJ named Lindy Shannon became obsessed with the song and played it into their local top 10. From there, it was picked up by the Soma label out of Minneapolis, who released it nationally and sent it soaring into the Billboard Hot 100, where it reached number 5 in June of 1960. By the end of the summer, Mule Skinner Blues had sold well over a million copies. The song itself was unusual. It featured just the two Fendermen, drenched in echo, no drums or bass, with Humphrey's delirious whooping and yodeling. Highlights included a number of deranged yucks and ha-has, and concluded with the classic cha-cha-cha. As the song took off, the now four-piece band continued to rehearse in that old garage on Main Street in Stoughton, and we kept a lookout for them so we could gather outside at a moment's notice. Mostly, we just stared in reverent jaw-dropping awe, not believing our luck. After all, the Fendermen, although practically teenagers themselves, were the biggest celebrities any of us had ever seen in our short, small-town Stoughton lives. By summer's end, they'd opened for Johnny Cash and Kitty Wells and appeared at the Grand Old Opry. A performance on Dick Clark's American Bandstand would follow, where they shared the bill with teen heartthrob Bobby Darin, who seemed downright subdued by comparison. And then, just like that, it was over. They released a full album called You Guessed It, Mule Skinner Blues, and continued to play as a popular live act. But amidst legal wranglings with their record company and without a follow-up hit, they disbanded in 1961. But Mule Skinner Blues lives on. To date, it has sold over 4.5 million copies worldwide and is a staple on oldies radio stations everywhere. The Fendermen may have provided Stoughton with only a footnote in the history of American music, but they made a lifelong rock and roll fan out of one 7-year-old living just around the corner on Norris Street.
Bill Amundson is an artist and rock and roll fan from Stoughton, and his essay was originally published in the Stoughton Courier-Hub. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Colbert.
Now, our colleagues at PBS Wisconsin introduce us to a lot of really interesting people and stories on Wisconsin Life. And one highlight of the current season is a profile of an amazing young woman named Shruti Partasarathy. She performs Bharatanatyam classical Indian dance around the world, and she does much more than that. Besides performing, she also teaches it to adults and young people as a form of stress relief. I spoke with Shruti last month and asked her how she first got started.
So when I came to the U.S., I was 5 years old, and my mom started to notice that I was speaking more English than my native language, which was Tamil. So she wanted me to go to Bharatanatyam class to learn more about my cultural history. So that was really the main reason why she put me into Bharatanatyam classes. She did not expect it to become like a passion of mine. I don't think even I expected it. It was something just so happened.
And you also talked in the Wisconsin Life profile about you that you were feeling a lot of stress and dance really helped you. Tell us a little bit about that point in your life.
Yeah. I think one thing that I struggled with being an Indian American, growing up in Wisconsin is finding a balance between my two identities. For a long time, I thought it was dichotomous in nature, that I couldn't be both Indian and American, respect both sides of my heritage. And because of that, I accumulated lots of stress. I found it really, really hard to pursue Bharatanatyam passionately while also living in Wisconsin, and finding opportunities to, you know, showcase my heritage. And on top of that, I think just being an adolescent in high school and middle school just adds a lot of pressure, and just the nature of the competitiveness. So all those things combined and made me really stressed. And I started to notice that I wasn't alone and my peers around me were going through a lot of the same experiences that I had. And I started to notice that when I was talking more about my cultural history to my peers, they were more accepting of it. They started to realize that, you know, these cultures aren't so myopic. They're not so dichotomous. There are so many similar elements, and it's just that I didn't know about it at that time. So I think I grew a passion to, you know, showcase my heritage in a way that combines both my identities, which is the basis of why I started Calm with Kala.
So let's talk about Calm with Kala. So you were using dance as a way to reduce your own stress, but like you said, you saw it in people around you. So you decided to share it, and that in and of itself can be stressful, trying to figure out, you know, do I want to put myself out there in this way? So how did you first kind of approach other people about, hey, you know, would you like to try this? It's been really great for me.
So starting Calm with Kala, I knew was a massive task, but it was something that I was really proud to take because I knew that's the direction I wanted to see change happen in my society. And I wanted more peers of mine to be accepting of their heritage, to be accepting of their culture. So at that moment, I was willing to, you know, go through any strides that needed to be taken. I spent a lot of my school lunches just sitting and calling people and trying to set up meetings just to get myself out there. And, you know, like with anything, when you start a project, it's not all like flowers. Mm-hmm. You go through a lot of struggles, and I was met with a lot of rejections at first. But it was taking those very few opportunities that were presented to me at first and expanding them into bigger and bigger opportunities. So particularly with Calm with Kala, I spent all my school lunches first semester, or at least most of them, finding freshman advisories in my school and teaching them during my lunches. And from there, I talked with the health department, and I eventually integrated Calm with Kala into the health curriculum. So now I have this program at Middleton High School where every single incoming freshman gets to experience Calm with Kala, which is amazing to me. And with that, I started taking it and expanding it to universities. And now I've given workshops at Yale and Princeton and Northwestern, and I'm really able to, you know, showcase that Calm with Kala is a sustainable solution that transcends age boundaries.
So you're helping people kind of find a center, find some balance by moving their bodies, but also the type of dance you're teaching has, it seems to me, a total non-dancer, some very kind of precise movements. Is it almost a meditation kind of moving through those sequences?
It definitely is. I talk about the uniqueness of Bharatanatyam, especially because it's a historically underrepresented art form. And when we talk about the rising epidemic in mental health, we find elements in Bharatanatyam to be uniquely, you know, centered around mental health therapies. I always talk about in my workshops how there are three different elements of Bharatanatyam. We have our facial expressions, our hand gestures, our footwork, and all these elements, when put together, make a complex sequence of movements. But really, when you dissect them, they're all just simple movements that anyone is able to do. And I think that's one thing that makes Bharatanatyam super unique, because you're able to explore these movements that are really, really simple in its roots. But when you put it together, you get this, you know, expansion of an art form or an artistic expression.
It's very, very expressive.
It
and
is, yeah.
And we will certainly post the video of you performing so people can find that. But besides being a high school student, besides starting this organization to share what you've learned, you also perform all over the world.
I do.
What is that like?
I think it's a blessing that I have the resources and a supportive family to take me around the world and follow me wherever I go to perform. So I really, really wanted to, you know, bounce off of that and make use of that. And dancing has been my passion since I was five when I started. And I think before Calm with Kala and all of that started, dancing was my way to express myself. And so because of that, I wanted to express myself in any way possible. Mm-hmm. So I found myself doing collaborations in New York with other artistic disciplines. And then I found myself going back to India and honing my technique with master teachers. And I think being Indian American gives me this unique, unique opportunity to explore two mediums of art forms. And I think by that, what I mean is that I'm able to not only hone my technique and further myself as an Indian classical dancer, as a Bharatanatyam dancer in Chennai and, you know, perform at some of the top auditoriums, I'm able to come to America and explore different art forms, collaborate with jazz, poetry, and these opportunities, you know, wouldn't be presented if I had just been raised in India. At the same time, honing my technique and becoming a more technical classical dancer wouldn't have been presented if I was just born in America. So I think being Indian American supports me in a lot of ways to explore the different mediums of artistic expression in Bharatanatyam itself.
So it sounds like when we first started talking, you said that you felt a little torn between the two identities and like they weren't working together. Now, years later, it seems like not only have they come together, but you feel that much more strong and
exactly.
and have so many more resources because of them.
Yes, exactly.
What would you say, Shruti, to someone maybe your age, maybe someone older, maybe someone my age, who is feeling kind of overwhelmed and just doesn't know how to kind of get out of that place of stress and feeling overwhelmed?
I think one thing that we need to note is, like, you know, stress is just a human emotion. We all go through it. It's nothing that someone faces alone, and we have to destigmatize stress because we put a lot of weight into it and we try not to talk about it because we think other people aren't going through it. But no matter what race you're from, what socioeconomic status you're from, whatever age you are, everyone goes through stress. And I think if you are stressed, again, which everyone goes through, is to just find your support system and just talk about it. I think talking about it is one way that, you know, helps, you know, reduce our stress level. But, you know, going back to self-expression, just finding your medium of self-expression, whether that's talking, dancing, singing, acting, finding your medium of self-expression really, really helps de-stress a person.
Well, Shruti, thank you so much and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Shruti Parasarathy is a classical Indian dancer from Middleton, Wisconsin, where she's a senior in high school. We have a link to the Wisconsin Life segment over at WPR.org/Central Time. You can see her teaching at Middleton High School and also performing. Coming up, just how many abandoned treadmills or discarded bread makers does a thrift store see in a day? We talked to an author who spent time in the donation centers of thrift stores to trace the journey of secondhand stuff. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 6 on the morning show, the Me Too movement was meant to raise awareness of sexual abuse and assault, but some women still feel forgotten. Kate Archer-Kent's guest has 25 years of experience of anti-violence work and shares the struggle of eliminating gender-based violence against women of color and their communities. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, downsizing, decluttering, updating, redecorating, they're all reasons that someone might want to get rid of some items that are no longer useful or wanted. With the best of intentions, we often turn to thrift stores or charities when we want to get rid of things, thinking and hoping that our old items will find a second life somewhere else and that someone else will enjoy them. While that's true in some cases, our next guest found that on average, thrift stores only sell about 1/3 of the items they put on their shelves, and many things don't even make it to the public. Adam Minter wanted to find out what really happens to our things after we're done with them, so he spent years in the places where our cast-offs go, from an importer of used goods in Africa to the donation center of Goodwill. Adam's new book is called Secondhand: Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. Adam, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
You got into the core issues of this book after your own mother passed away, and your sister needed to deal with the stuff she left behind. And I think that's really a situation so many people can relate to. What kind of thoughts were you having as you went through that process?
Well, it's sort of the second period of mourning uh, that, you know, those of us who live in consumer societies encounter. You know, after your parent is gone or your loved one or your friend, you are left with that material legacy. These things that may have mattered to your relative, but don't necessarily matter that much to you. And we reach the end of this process of cleaning out my mother's home and cleaning stuff out of garages of relatives where she had left stuff. And we found ourselves staring at her china, saying to each other, "You take it. No, you take it. No, you take it." We knew my mother loved that china, but we realized neither of us really wanted it or had space for it. So we decided we'd take it to a Goodwill. And as I was waiting in line to at a donation center in Minnesota to drop it off at a drive-through donation center, it occurred to me that this might be a good subject for a book, because we are not the only people to do this. And there's, you know, there was a lineup of people there dropping off things that they probably didn't know where it was going either. So it struck me as a very personal way that people could identify with to get into the subject of what happens to all of our excess, because clearly our relatives can't handle all this stuff. So who's going to handle it?
Well, And as we said, many of us, for a variety of reasons, end up in this situation, whether it's someone else's things that are left or our own that maybe we need to downsize, or we're spring cleaning, right, or maybe we're moving for the fifth time and we realize we've been lugging the same stuff from residence to residence. We attach value to these things, whether it's sentimental value or we think that it's quote unquote worth something, but mm-hmm. that's often pretty far from what the truth really is.
Right. And I think, you know, for me, going through this journey, not just of trying to figure out what to do with my mother's stuff, but watching what happens with all the stuff that's going through these donation doors, it was the sort of the revelation that the stuff that we have in our homes really isn't worth very much to anybody but to ourselves. You know, you may have paid $2,000 for that beautiful dining room table, but and it may have meant something to you and your family, and you have memories of Thanksgivings and all kinds of events around it. But the fact that you have sentimental value built into that doesn't mean you're going to be able to find somebody to pay $2,000 for it. Or for that matter, you may not be able to find a donation center that wants it, because there is such an excess of these beautiful tables out there right now, and they are out of fashion. And so that's where it becomes, you know, quite difficult, and you start to see how much of our identity is built around these things that we value so much and attach such powerful sentimental value to, but there's no correspondence to actual real value in the world, something that somebody else would buy. So it's all about what matters to you personally, but it doesn't really matter to, if you will, the market that's out there for stuff.
And one of the interesting aspects of this is tastes change, and things that were in style or in fashion and really kind of a status symbol for a generation or two ago just really don't fit in what we think of as a modern home often.
Right, exactly. And if you go, say, to any antique mall that you may have there in Wisconsin, you will find an excess of what's called in the business brown furniture. And I think we all know instinctively what that means when you say the term about brown furniture. It's just not in fashion anymore. And yet 50 years ago, people couldn't wait to get their hands on that beautiful oak furniture. And so it goes out of fashion, and suddenly people are buying things that have cleaner lines. And you have an entire antique establishment, if you will, that has to figure out where this stuff can go. And it's not just the big things, you know, like the big pieces of oak furniture. I mean, along the way of reporting this book, you know, I kept hearing about how Hummel figurines, and I think some of your listeners will certainly know what these small German porcelains look like, which, you know, would go for $300-$400 a few years ago. You're having a hard time getting $20-$30 for some of them anymore, because the people who love those things are passing on and the next generation doesn't want them. And so, again, it becomes one of these situations where the absolute value of something, the monetary value, really isn't there when the sentimental value goes away.
We're talking with Adam Minter right now about his new book, Secondhand: Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. And Adam, one of the aspects of your book that I found the most interesting is that in the United States, a whole industry has grown up around this issue of people needing to clean out the homes of their loved ones, either when they move to, say, a care facility or when they pass away. And it's not just people who are dealing with the stuff. They are also dealing with their relatives who are wrestling with the feeling of getting rid of things that they feel like there should be something better to do with them.
Yeah, exactly. The move management industry, which, you know, in some sense probably has existed for centuries, the idea that somebody would help you clean out your home and take the stuff with them. But it's become formalized in the last 20 and 30 years. And there's actually an association of what's called move managers. And what they do is, yes, they'll come in and help you pack things up, but at the same time, they will sort of counsel you, you know, talk to you about your stuff, you know, especially older relatives who are very attached to the things that, you know, they've lived with for 50 or 60 years. That wedding china, you know, they may have that wedding china and several other sets of china. And so they will counsel them, literally counsel them on, you know, why this probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense to take with them. So I spent time with these businesses, and it can be really heartbreaking encounters that you see these move managers have, you know, with people. And it's not just in the United States either. Japan also has a similar industry, and they are facing some of the similar pressures that we have in the United States with an aging demographic that has acquired a lot of stuff through a very affluent period, and they can't take it with them, whether it means to senior housing or, you know, if they pass along, you know, they can't take it with them there either. So it's a very big industry, and it's going to grow, especially as the United States ages further and we see these very affluent generations trying to figure out who is going to get their stuff, where it's going to go.
And it's interesting, Adam, because it's definitely not, as you just said, an American problem. This also happens in Japan, European countries, elsewhere. But one of the biggest differences, it seems, is that Americans have more room in their homes to put more stuff.
Exactly. And that's the big difference is, you know, over the last 50 years, the American house has grown by almost the average American house has grown by almost 50%. Americans have gone through a period of incredible affluence. So they've been able to buy stuff to fill up those homes with. And the price of so many goods has declined. So those homes are filling up with stuff that, you know, that may have been valued by the person who bought them. But because the price of goods has fallen, the quality of goods has fallen. And so it's less desirable, if desirable at all, to somebody else who's looking to acquire it. So you have more stuff filling bigger homes that nobody wants. And that's becoming a real problem. And it's where these move managers and other services that are out there to help people downsize become really important.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Mike in Madison is up. Hi, Mike. Hello, Mike.
Yes.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi. So I am about to go deal with this same situation your guest was talking about, and I was wondering if you had some options for me. Unfortunately, the past 6 months with my father's dementia, he's gone on massive spending sprees. Fortunately, we've been able to catch a lot of it and return it, where he would buy, like, a microwave every day or buy things he thought he needed. And we've been able to return a lot of it, but we're finding things that he has secret stashed all over. And so I know you guys talked about giving away some of it, but unfortunately, in order to keep my stepmother in the home, we need to sell a lot of stuff. And I'm wondering if an auction is perhaps an idea, or what I'm asking is there any options for the best way to kind of recoup some of the cost? Because he's run up almost $32,000 on credit card bills in the past 6 months.
And thanks for that call, Mike, and sorry that you're in that situation. Adam, I know you probably can't give very specific advice to Mike, but in your research, did you find some things that seem to work better for people who are in that situation where they really actually need to recoup some of the value?
Yeah, it's really hard because, you know, as anybody who's ever bought a new car knows, when you drive that new thing off the car lot, the proverbial car lot, it loses a lot of value. And so recouping value is very difficult. The one thing I would say, I mean, you know, I found myself in this position. So it's very hard to go out there and say, I'm going to sell each and every item off. It's incredibly time consuming. And you got to measure, you know, how much your time is worth. But my advice then would be to find somebody, a clean out service, somebody who's going to go in there and take the stuff that nobody wants, as well as some of the valuable stuff, and you know, just face up to the fact you're going to take a loss on some of it.
So they'll go in, clear it out, and I think, remembering from your book, they will give you a price quote, but they will actually deduct a little bit for things that they feel that they can make some money on.
Exactly. I mean, the amount of time that goes into, say, doing an estate sale for most families isn't worth it, and they don't have enough stuff to sell in the first place. So the best option is to let somebody come in and just take the whole thing, and there'll be a fee involved, or maybe they will pay you something, but you're not going to recoup the value from everything, but at least you're going to have it off your hands.
We're talking right now with Adam Minter about his new book, Secondhand: Travels in the Global Garage Sale. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you had to downsize or get rid of someone else's things? Do you frequently donate to thrift stores? And do you have questions about the secondhand market? How likely are you to buy items secondhand? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with Adam Minter. He's a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion and the author of the new book, Secondhand: Travels in the Global Garage Sale. And I want to zero in on that global garage sale part of this, Adam. How is our thrift store and stuff market in the U.S. connected to markets all over the world?
Well, intricately. And if there weren't markets all over the world for our stuff, there'd be a lot more stuff not being reused and a lot of it headed to landfills and incinerators. There's two really big areas that do go abroad and where there are markets for our stuff. The first is secondhand clothes. There's huge demand overseas for secondhand clothes from North America, and especially from the colder parts of North America. When you think about it, most of the world that's importing secondhand clothes are warm weather climates, and so they really like lightly worn summer clothes. So in Wisconsin, for example, you know, the summers are relatively short, and people don't wear their summer clothes for very long, so they tend to be in good shape when they go to donation centers. There's huge demand for that in places like Africa and Southeast Asia. The other set of, and so if it wasn't going there, a lot of it would not be going anywhere. It would be ended up in landfill. And the other area is electronics, things like computers, things like smartphones. Anybody who's traded in a smartphone recently knows that there's demand for it. There's value in it. And a lot of that value is coming from overseas, where people can't afford expensive new devices, a $1,000 phone. So they're willing to go back a couple generations, spend a little less, but at least it connects them to the internet and gets them online and sort of bridges that digital gap. So again, instead of that stuff being landfilled, although it probably wouldn't be landfilled, but recycled, it's actually reused. And that's overall better for the environment. And it's also better for our closets and desk drawers because it means the stuff has somewhere to go. There's demand for it.
You do say in your book, Adam, that there's an interesting trend now that good quality clothes are actually getting less expensive, and that makes the secondhand clothing that often is of inferior quality less appealing.
Yeah, I mean, there's a big shift now in the global secondhand clothing trade because East Asian manufacturing in particular has become so good at making clothing so cheaply that new clothing, especially in developing regions, is competing aggressively against secondhand clothing. And so that means that the price of secondhand clothing on the global markets and demand for secondhand clothing in developing countries is falling off. And it's happening just at a time when people in places like Japan and the United States and Canada and Europe are buying more clothes than ever. We all know about the fast fashion phenomenon, you know, people buying essentially disposable clothing that will only last three or four washes or three or four weeks, you know, in terms of fashion cycles. And so you're actually that sort of thing combined with the drop off in demand in these developing countries means that there is more excess clothing that's going to have fewer places to go. And that's posing a real long-term structural challenge to organizations like Goodwills and Salvation Armies and other businesses that take sort of the middle market secondhand clothing.
We're talking with Adam Minter right now about his new book, Secondhand: Travels in the Global Garage Sale. And let's go to the phones. And Jeff in West Salem is up. Hi, Jeff.
Well, how are you doing this afternoon?
Good. What would you like to share?
Well, I know since I retired, and even before that, I've been doing a little rummage sailing, you know, in the summertime. And the one thing that I've noticed is people don't Well, all the old timers are selling all their old tools, everything from socket wrenches to table saws and planers and joiners. And, you know, I think there's nobody that uses that stuff anymore, or very few people. And I think a lot of it probably just ends up going to the junkyard and sold as scrap prices.
And thank you for that call, Jeff. And Adam, that touches on a couple of things. You do talk specifically about tools, and also you grew up in a family of junkyard owners.
We did. I grew up in a Minneapolis, a small Minneapolis scrap metal recycling operation. And so what he says is true. I mean, as a young person who worked in that business, I saw a lot of these old tools come in, and he's absolutely right. This isn't just a recent phenomenon. It goes back a couple decades where we would get that stuff. There's no secondhand market, at least no immediate secondhand market for that stuff. And so it would be put into the bins that were sent to steel mills or you know, whatever type of metal it was for remelting. So you would lose that stuff. It's frustrating. You know, as I traveled the world looking at this book, I did find places that really did like those beautiful old hand tools, because those tools the gentleman just called about are beautifully made. I mean, they're very durable. But folks in the States in particular are just not using that stuff anymore. But you certainly can find people in Africa, for example, in Ghana and Kenya, where I've been, and you'd see that stuff there and they'd use it. But, you know, the trick is, how do you connect the buyers and the sellers? And so often that's the real difficulty is, you know, there may be somebody in northern Ghana who would love to get their hands on those tools, but it's, you know, how do we connect that person with somebody in Wisconsin who has them? And so in many cases, because it's so difficult and so expensive to move that stuff between the people who want it and the people who have it, it ends up getting recycled, and we lose that beautiful tool forever.
And Adam, you do advocate for things like the right to repair or labeling that actually talks about what durability you can expect from that. Would those be good steps in helping us avoid some of this waste?
Absolutely. Right to repair is a great movement, and I know you've had legislation introduced in Wisconsin to do it, which is just the idea that manufacturers have to share with consumers the documentation of how to fix their stuff. You know, if you buy a phone, an iPhone, for example, today, Apple will not let you see the repair documentation. Now, very few people are going to repair their own iPhone, but there's lots of independent businesses that would love to get access to that kind of documentation so they can repair it for you. And so if you allow people to get their stuff fixed, it's going to last longer. The other item that I've advocated for, you know, sort of dealing with some of these problems is just, as you said, something called durability labeling, which is this idea, which has been tested out in Europe, that manufacturers should have to put a sticker, say, on something that they make, saying how long that they expect it to last. And in many cases, especially with, you know, mechanical goods, say like a washing machine, or in terms of textiles like a shirt, they can tell you how many times they expect it to last in the washer, how many cycles they expect it to last when it's washing. And that kind of thing we found in Europe has actually helped people buy better for themselves. They'll spend a little bit more to get something that's going to last a little longer. And that's ultimately the goal, because we don't want people, you know, you don't want people buying lots of disposable things. It's not good for the pocketbook, and it's not good for the environment either. So if you can get folks to be buying on their own better, more long-lasting stuff, it's gonna benefit everybody and be one step, not the only step, to dealing with this problem of houses overflowing with stuff.
It can be really hard, even when you know that there's not a market for things. Let's go back to that old China, and we had a caller that we're not going to have time to go to saying, you know, isn't there maybe a historical society or something that would take it? What, Adam, in our last minute here, would you like us all to leave this conversation with in thinking about our relationship to items and stuff?
Well, I would say two things. One, I mean, it's really long past due for people to stop investing so much of their identities in the stuff that they buy. I mean, you know, I advocate, you know, when people buy gifts for people at a wedding or whatever it is, buy experiences. You know, at this point in human history, we're probably too far along to be you know, spending our time investing so much in a set of china. You know, it's eventually going to end up, everything ends up in the trash bin eventually anyway. Very, very little stuff, you know, goes on and ends up in a museum, a historical society. So keep that in mind about where stuff is going to go when you buy it, because ultimately it's not going to end up in that museum. And I think when you start buying and consuming with that in mind, you're going to make better choices, and you're going to be leaving fewer messes for yourself and for your relatives.
Well, Adam, thank you so much for joining us. It was a really interesting conversation and book.
Thank you so much.
Adam Minter is a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion and the author of the new book, Secondhand, Travels in the Global Garage Sale. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk with Senator Jennifer Schilling, a Democrat, and Republican Representative Jim Steinecke about the priorities that their parties will be working towards in 2020. And are we at risk of further escalation of tensions between Iran and the U.S.? We'll be joined by an advisor to the Defense Department on Middle East policy to talk about the actions of the United States in the last week and whether we can expect more of a response from Iran in the future. And we'll talk with a psychotherapist about the benefits of journaling, how to do it and why, and we'll ask for your stories too. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow after 7, with marijuana now legal in several states surrounding Wisconsin, a legal expert joins Kate Archer-Kent to discuss what residents crossing the border should keep in mind. We examine what policing could look like, repercussions of possession, and discuss individuals' rights around search and seizure procedures. That's tomorrow morning at 7, right here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then a writer tries online dating for the first time and thinks of it as a scientific experiment. She shares her findings with us. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.
Thank you for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for your gift.
Thank you for your support.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks to members like you, WPR is a place where every day we can learn something new, get news we trust, expand our perspective, and enjoy great entertainment just when we need it. Your support makes everything you enjoy on WPR possible. Thank you.
PBS Wisconsin is proud to offer Bright by Text, a free texting service for parents and caregivers of children ages 8 and younger. Text the word BADGER to 274-448 and receive research-based, age-specific resources and activities from trusted content partners like PBS Kids. Get free educational resources delivered to your phone with Bright by Text from PBS Wisconsin. Just text BADGER to 274-448.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. In a possible bid to de-escalate a crisis, President Trump struck a conciliatory tone toward Iran in his first remarks since